everybody. Welcome to the PC Perspective Podcast. This is episode 308, being recorded on July 9th, 2014. I'm Ryan Schrout.
I'm Jeremy Hellstrom.
I'm Josh Walrath.
I'm Mark Titleman.
And I'm Alan Malventano.
We're not meant for five people.
Yeah, we're not used to having five people, so the order of things, usually it's either Alan or Maury.
I already showed Alan as well, so...
That's true.
Yeah,
come back to him. So welcome to the show, everybody. It's been another week, I guess. If you want to watch us record the show live... Quick reminder, we do that at pcper.com/live at about 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. And if you want to be notified when we go live, you can go to this nice little webpage here called pcper.com/subscribe. And you sign up with your name and email address here. Real easy. And we send you an email, usually like an hour to half hour before we actually start the live stream. So if you're interested in signing up for that, we would love for you to do so. Yeah, that's about that. So next week will be an interesting week. We'll be at QuakeCon. We, of course, are hosting the PC Perspective Hardware Workshop on Saturday, July 19th at noon local time. So that's central, right? Yeah. Texas is central. That sounds right.
Central is Texas, yeah.
Yep. So you can see here, we've got – if you go to pcper.com/workshop, you can see our fancy new logo for the Hardware Workshop there. Sponsors this year, thanks to Seasonic, NVIDIA, and Logitech on that. And our list of prizes has been growing. If you have not seen it recently, you need to go check it out. We've got AMD, BitPhoenix, Corsair, EVGA, Fractal Design, Galaxy, G-Scale, NWIN, Logitech, Kingston, MSI, NVIDIA, OCZ, Rokat, Seasonic, Silverstone, Western Digital, XFX, Zotac, and at least a couple of more that I just don't have confirmation on what those particular products are yet. So if you're in the Dallas area, if you're coming to QuakeCon, you want to be sure you are here, or there, rather, on Saturday, July 19th. We will be live streaming it, if everything goes as planned, at pcper.com/live, and it'll be embedded at pcper.com/workshop as well. And we are definitely going to have a podcast recording on Wednesday night at QuakeCon. So... Wednesday at 9 p.m. local time. Is that right, Maury?
Wait,
you're 1 hour behind Eastern time,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes.
You're the only Texas guy now. Yes. I'm trying to bring you in the conversation.
9 p.m. QuakeCon time.
QuakeCon time?
That's right. That is an official time zone.
It's in the Windows thing here.
We will be at the Emerald Room, which is directly across from the main stage.
Isn't the strip club?
No, it's the Emerald. That's the Emerald Club. We'll be there afterwards. The Emerald Room is where we start. And we'll probably have a couple of prizes to give away as well. And I think last time we did Q&A and we drank beer and stuff like that. So
someone brought beer.
Yeah,
they did.
So we'll be there again on Wednesday. We'll record at the same normal time. So it'll just be 9 p.m. local time in Dallas in the Emerald Room. And we'll try to have that all set up.
Yeah, with Pipe Wrench.
Yeah.
Hopefully I'll actually be there this time.
You showed up.
I showed up right at the end.
Yeah, we did watch the video again today to kind of make sure how we had everything formatted. We actually had two cameras last time. I forgot about that.
Oh, yeah.
One camera to show. We keeping you awake?
I'm still jet lagged.
Man, oh. No, you're not jet lagged.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the workshop. Also, if you want to come to QuakeCon, and you don't have a BYOC spot yet, we actually have two BYOC spots that were given to us by my buddies at PC Part Picker to give away. So if you go to the homepage at pcper.com, there's a news post about win a BYOC seat at QuakeCon 2014. And it's really simple. Like, all you have to do is send us your name and email. But I implore you, you must be able to attend QuakeCon between July 17th and July 20th, and actually make use of the BYOC spot that we're going to give you. Otherwise, there's no point in you winning it, and it's just a waste for everybody. So only enter if you can actually be there. What's that?
Can we apply?
You're going to be working, so you don't have time to play games. So no? You can enter, I guess.
Oh, man.
Right?
You can still bring your own computer if you want to look it around, but...
Yeah, we will draw the winner on Friday, so we only got a day or so to enter this. If we want to make sure you have time to know if you're going to be at QuakeCon or not, so sign up for that if you can, we would appreciate it more. Did you have any last-minute updates on the status of QuakeCon 2014 for us?
Yes, I do. I have quite a few. First one, big one, food trucks will be back. They're kind of doing a weird thing with the schedule this year, though. During the day till 8 p.m., the hotel will be doing burgers and pizza. From 8 till sometime in the morning, sometime between 2 a.m. and 8 a.m., the food trucks will be there. So it's going to be late-night food truck service. They have not announced what food trucks are there, but there will be food trucks there. And they're not going to be out by the BYOC. They're going to be by the Chantilly room or something. So I don't know what they're going to do there, but you'll be able to find them. There is going to be a magic... the Magic card game people are going to be doing a preview of their new set. They're going to be having a competition Friday night from 7 to 11. It's a $25 entry fee, and you get 5 decks, including a special card of the new deck sets. You can pre-register for that if you want. If you don't, you don't have to. They're going to have a blood drive there, and in my opinion, not the smartest thing, but if you do the blood drive, you get something called the Chill Pack for some new Bethesda game coming out. I don't recall what the game is.
So get really drunk and give blood?
And the blood will be sterile.
Diseases. I don't. It doesn't make much sense because I mean, it sounds like it's a good.
Well, because the person who receives the blood will be twice as happy.
Hey, look, all the people there are virgins anyway, so it's not like they're picking up any STDs that they can pass on.
Wow, you're a virgin. You have kids, Josh.
Well, they're adopted.
So it's technically
true.
That one is true. Yeah.
No, I know. Yeah, I do the same thing. My parents never had to have sex either. So because me and my brother adopted.
There you go. See, it's
I
a world full
okay.
of
becomes a long line of virgins.
Couple more.
Okay.
Real quick. There is a Lyft. There's something called Lyft that is going to be a QuakeCon sponsor or some kind of exhibitor. They are giving a free $25 credit. Basically, they will take you anywhere you want. And you pay, you know, you use your credit, you pay them, and they'll take you there and back. And you just have to, there's some app or something on the, I guess it's iPhone, Android, all that crap. Let's see what else. There is, Master Pancake is going to be there. I think I said this last week, 9 to 12. They're going to be doing Labyrinth. It will be a hoot. That's awesome.
Yeah.
They also have their schedule app live through Guidebook. You can get that on iPhone and Android.
Yep.
And the schedule is out.
It has the PC Perspective Hardware Workshop on it, so that's what counts.
Mm-hmm. They will also be giving away copies of
ESO.
Something ESO. That's right. Yeah, 3,000 copies of that, and it will be having a. And also, they will be showing the keynote is very important. If you're there to go to the keynote this year, I think it's at 6 p.m. because they will. That is the only place we'll be showing Doom 4. That is it.
I'm going to go with probably that will be screwed up at some point.
Yeah.
Probably. Aren't they going to make it playable or something? Didn't I hear that?
There was rumors about a beta, but that's not. Oh, one more thing, too. And this is confirmed. Because last week it was not quite confirmed.
Half-Life 3, right?
If you have a QDQ spot, if you have a QuakeCon done quick, and you get there on Wednesday night, they will let you in. They will let you set up a computer, and you can start gaming that night. You get because of QDQ, you get an early gaming spot. You don't have to wait till Thursday morning. You can start gaming and start up on everything Wednesday night. But not everyone. That is just QDQ. If you're just a BYOC, you can't do that. You can basically get in line Wednesday, drop your shit off, and go. But if you have QDQ,
do whatever. That's
good. It'll spread the line out a little bit at least. In other words, those people wouldn't be waiting.
How many QDQs were there?
Somewhere between 250 and 500.
Yeah, see,
not a lot.
You've always been able to set up on Wednesday night.
No.
Really?
No, you couldn't. All you could do is you could drop your shit off, take your carts, and that's it. You couldn't set up or anything. If they caught you set up, they'd smack you.
But you're dropping all your stuff there. You just can't plug in your mouse and keyboard and network cable?
Well, no, you can't. You can't even unbox if you like. If you have basically, you can put your monitor and stuff on a table, and that's it.
Yeah, the boxes.
You cannot.
If it takes you very long to set up your computer after that, you don't belong in a LAN party.
Yeah. No, it's going to take me about 15 minutes to set up my computer.
15
You'll
minutes,
see.
That's fine.
It's going to be a beast.
It involves plumbing.
I've been seriously working on my computer for the past like 5 or 6 days every night. It's insane.
I know.
I've been fabricating parts and all sorts of wacky.
I built ours in 3 hours today.
Yeah.
<I know. laughs>
All right, let's get in and talk about hardware and things that happened. Scott posted a story earlier in the week about kind of dove into a little bit about the comments that Intel made publicly confirming that they had showed and expressed interest in AMD's Mantle API. They confirmed it in a PC World story that they labeled it as an experiment, the Intel spokesperson said. And AMD's response was, give us a month or two and we'll go into the 1.0 phase sometime this year, which basically confirms kind of what we had or what we learned with our discussion with Richard Huddy a few weeks ago, that they were in a beta stage and that they did not want to open it up to everybody quite yet. But when it was open to everybody, that anybody would be able to enter, right? Intel being one of those anybodies. So the interesting discussion that Scott has in the story is kind of, why would Intel want access to Mantle? What would they find interesting in Mantle to take advantage of? And it's kind of an interesting debate, right? Because most of the benefits for Mantle games come in situations where you are processor limited, and Intel's processors are faster than AMD's processors, so you're less likely to be processor limited with Intel parts than you would be with AMD parts. But you are still getting some advantages.
Yep.
Right. And Intel has integrated graphics, so anytime you can improve performance in that and improve efficiency in that, they are obviously interested in doing it. I'm curious, like, when that request for the Mantle API access was actually made versus how DirectX 12 comes into play with all of this. Mm-hmm.
We have no idea on a time.
Yeah. If you look through the story, like Scott talks about, we're even talking, if we get into like the Bay Trail part of things, right? Will that improve performance in games with Bay Trail? Will they be able, if AMD decides to make Mantle available in Linux, will they be able to do that, take it down to Android level, right?
Yeah.
That's obviously a distant idea.
I mean, in a roundabout way, it might lead to reduced battery life.
No, in fact, it improved would be battery quite life. The opposite.
Reduced battery
use.
Consumption.
Use. Consumption.
Right. Because that processor doesn't have to do as much work to get the nice, pretty images onto your screen.
Yep, less overhead, so.
Yeah.
It's an interesting idea. I think it will be the very, very end of this year before AMD actually opens up the Mantle API, which again cuts down on the lead that it would have over DirectX. Will other developers kind of slow down on Mantle development? Will companies like Intel or even NVIDIA have any more interest in that API at all? Right? NVIDIA is obviously the far out, the one who's probably never, ever, ever going to adopt Mantle.
I feel like everything slowed down as soon as they said there was going to be another DirectX.
Yeah, definitely. And I, honestly, I don't even think Intel would do it. Right, I think
A positive thing, if Mantle,
what's
because
that?
It is curated by a single person, well, single company, they can add advancements very, very quickly as compared to what DirectX or OpenGL can do.
But that's not really beneficial to Intel, right? Because the advancements
that Mantle
would
make if
would
AMD's
be
saying, "Hey, we're going to go here and we're going to do this," Intel will probably, after 6 or 7 months, or a next, product generation, they'll be able to add those in, those features, and support it, which is still a lot faster than what we see with, again, DirectX and OpenGL.
Yeah, Intel has never been one to really show us that they are capable of adopting new
APIs. You mean
APIs.
They have a not invented here attitude?
that too, right? Like, if they didn't come up with it, they're not going to use it. Or
except, like, x86, 64.
Right, but they just waited until they could just dominate the whole market, and then nobody even thinks that it was an AMD invention, right? It's just, well, now it's 64-bit.
They're more Borgish than Care Bear. They're not going to adopt it. They're going to assimilate it, if anything.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And, it's interesting. Intel has never been really keen on, like, when DirectX 10 came out, making sure that was adopted, DirectX 11, because those types of API changes were really looking at image quality enhancements, things that make things look better, where Intel was, that's useful for AMD and NVIDIA's discrete GPUs, but for integrated graphics, you're not really worried about that, right? You're trying to get as much performance as you can out of DirectX 10 or 9 or whatever it is, right? And
you know, I'm sorry, I've got to stop this podcast. My battery is running low.
Yes.
I didn't get much sleep last night.
No, it's okay. It's okay. We understand. But this instance with Mantle, you would think, you know, here's an instance where apparently our battery is very low.
It's going fast.
3% in a minute? Just, come on.
That's unfortunate.
Wow. Quick. Plug it in. Quick, hurry.
It's the magic hand.
Hurry.
Everyone talk really, really quick.
Oh, there we go.
There you go. Much better. But with Mantle, like you say, well, now the benefit is not necessarily new image quality features or advancements. It's efficiency and battery life.
Yeah.
Potentially, which is something that Intel is actually interested in.
Yeah, they are interested in that, definitely.
So,
and certainly they would like their driver team, all two of them, to get as much time under their belt with something that is similar to DirectX 12 and perhaps move that knowledge forward.
Right. That would be my other thought, is they're just trying to get a head start on what they can learn with
DirectX. Yeah, I mean, it'd be silly for them to not think that they would at least want to dabble, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
but
their Intel, obviously they can ask. For something
well, yeah,
like
but
that.
But if they're Intel, so they may not want to, because that's an AMD thing.
No, yeah.
So you want to admit, it's the same reason why I don't think NVIDIA would do it, because they don't really want to admit that Mantle
but it's
was
not the, it's
a
not
good idea that they should have maybe done.
It's not so much that it's AMD, it's a graphics thing.
Yeah, but it's an AMD thing.
Yeah.
Right, it is.
You can look at it either way, though, right?
It's GameWorks like, is an NVIDIA
you know,
thing.
I'm sure they're not asking about it because of, you know, their awesome CPUs, AMD's awesome CPUs.
No.
Well, you know, and Intel like, hey, is kind of changing thing. As a company. I mean, they're opening up their fabs
yeah.
to other guys to go and start using as a foundry.
That's true.
They're more than willing to license out stuff from other people than we have seen previously. I think that they are slowly moving to a more flexible position instead of just, you know, a very solid, hey, this wasn't invented here. We're not going to deal with it. I mean, they've had a lot of experiences in the past. I mean, look at Epic. Their 64-bit. I mean, it failed miserably. They spent billions of dollars on that. AMD comes out with something that was, you know, an extension of x86, and it made a lot of sense. It did, like, quadrupled the amount of registered. It did all kinds of things that they really needed to get to where 64-bit needed to be, and did it in a pretty logical and effective way. And so I think, you know, a lot of the top guys that have been in Intel and have been kind of dictating their culture, they're all gone. And they got new folks in. And
I hope so.
They realized they got their butts kicked in mobile. That was an area that they could have dominated because Apple came to them first. And they said, no, we can't, you know, make these chips at that price. We just don't think that you had the volume. Well, guess what? The volume was not only there, it was well past what they expected. And I think that a lot of these hard lessons that they've learned, I think maybe, hopefully, they are a little bit more open to some outside technology to make their company stronger.
I hope so. Check out that editorial from Scott if you want to see more information on there. And there's actually a good kind of like thread going in the comments of it as well. Up next is Maury's review of an XSPC RayStorm D5 Photon RX 480 V3 water cooling kit.
Wow.
So I'm not even really sure. What is the company that manufactures this product, Maury?
Gigabyte.
Oh, it's a Gigabyte product. Okay.
No, it's not. No, the company is actually called XSPC.
Okay.
They've been in the water cooling business for a couple of years. I mean, quite a few years, actually. They're really known for making some pretty innovative designs that are very affordable. And I've said this before in other reviews. I mean, their stuff isn't the priciest. I mean, this kit is pretty pricey, but this is their top-of-the-line kit. Comes with their RayStorm block, which is very well known for its performance. It comes with the Photon Reservoir, which is a 170-millimeter reservoir with an inline D5 pump at the bottom. It comes with a 4x120, which is a 480-millimeter radiator, which is a big radiator, and it's extra thick. The radiator itself, the thickness of the radiator is about, I think it's about 45 millimeters, which is almost double of a 25 millimeter fan.
Okay.
And it, of course, comes with two fans with it and tubing and all that stuff. It's a nice kit, and it comes with LEDs because you can put LEDs on the both block and in the reservoir. The reservoir also has an acrylic glow stick in the middle that basically you put the LED in the bottom, and it can, if you want to... If you put the LED in the bottom and the middle glow stick glows whatever color. Comes with white by default, but you can put whatever color in there, red, blue, green, whatever LED. And I think it's a 5mm LED. It uses the CPU block uses 3mm LEDs. It's a really nice kit. When we were testing it, we started doing something with these DIY kits where we test it not only with the CPU block, but we test it with an inline GPU block as well. We have an ASUS Poseidon GTX 780 that we use for testing. Just because that adds about 300 watts of heat to the block, and that's where a lot of these kits with the bigger radiators really stand out. Okay. In testing, you know, just running the CPU block, really didn't see much difference between this kit and the other XSPC kit that only had the 280 millimeter radiator, which is two 120 millimeter fans. Where we saw the big differences were when you added the inline graphics card. Basically, running with a 480 millimeter radiator, there was no change in temperature on the CPU between with and without the video card. With every other block, you would see the processor temperature jump up, and that's because basically the radiator can dissipate quite a bit of heat. So that's really with this kind of kit where you see the changes. The other thing that hypothesis I put out in this review was that I think we were hitting the thermal limits of the Razor block, how much heat it could actually dissipate. Because again, theoretically, if there was more expansion room in the thermals for that Razor block, you should see a difference even without the GPU in temperature. With a bigger radiator, you should see lower temps on the CPU block, whether it's running with the video card or without. But basically, the CPU block, running a CPU block alone, the temperatures between the 240 millimeter radiator with the Razor block and the 480 millimeter with the Razor block were identical, both in stock and overclock. Stock, we'd expect that because, you know, stock speeds, the temperatures don't change between anything. But even overclock speeds, the temperatures were very close. So, I mean, that really indicates that you're reaching the thermal limits of that block itself. So
I mean, where do you kind of fall on this, right? What's it cost, and is this a product that you really think don't really purchase this if you're only going to cool a processor? You want to have a multi-component loop with a product like this? I mean, with a 480 millimeter radiator, I guess that makes sense. But is that kind of where you're at with it?
Yeah. You don't want to purchase this. I mean, if you're only cooling your processor, you do not want to purchase this. You don't want to. And if you're dabbling in water cooling, but you're not really wanting to deal with, you know, if you're not a diehard enthusiast or diehard enthusiast, you don't want to do this kit. I mean, the people who want the kit itself is about $315. But when you add the cost of the parts together, it's actually cheaper than it would be if you bought them individually. I mean, the radiator itself is probably about somewhere between $75 and $125. The block is about $60 to $75. The pump and reservoir combo is probably about $100 to $125. And then you have the tubing and the compression fittings as well. Yeah. It doesn't come with coolant. That's one of the weaknesses of the Razor kit. But a lot of the DIY kits don't come with coolant. Some of them do, but a lot of them don't.
Do you use Kool-Aid or something?
I actually use coolant. For this test, I use coolant. So I kind of gave up on making my own coolant because I was seeing some oddities with it, and also the mix I was using is not acrylic safe, so I didn't want to damage that center core. So I ended up using coolants, which is acrylic safe. You can also run regular distilled as long as you have all copper. You know, the problem with running distilled is if you have mixed metals, if you have copper and aluminum, you will corrode you will corrode both. Basically, you'll see pit. You'll see pitting in the aluminum, and you'll see build up on the copper.
Sounds like science.
A lot of people say, "Oh, that doesn't happen. You know, you have to be touching." It doesn't have to be touching. The liquid. And Alan, you could back me up on this if you want, or you know, chime in on this because I know you know a lot about this stuff too.
What about galvanic corrosion?
Galvanic corrosion. But yep. Basically, what happens is that one of them acts as a cathode, one of them acts as an anode, and the water is a conductor. So even if you have tubing in between them, you still have conduction there, and it will still, you know, you still get pitting. Where that becomes a real big problem is if usually you'll see it on the CPU blocks and on the GPU blocks in the microchannels, because microchannels will get gunked up with the aluminum bits that are basically being eaten off. This is a really nice kit. I mean, I gave it a gold award because I really liked it. The weird thing was the oddity with the block. But again, you know, overclocking at 4770K, you know, at 4.7 gigahertz, you're gonna see high 80s to mid to high 80s, no matter what, you know, cooler you use.
Yeah, that's what we found. It's the release of Haswell parts, yeah. Really.
It looks like a good foundation for if you're going to build one of those crazy rigs and you intend to do multiple GPU water blocks and everything else, you're going to need the higher capacity radiator.
Right.
Because you're doing that, right? But you need all those other parts anyway.
You know, exactly. Would this pump be big enough to do like a multi-GPU plus a processor?
What do you think, Maury?
Yeah, you could easily run a Crossfire setup, probably a chipset, and your CPU block through here, and it wouldn't even blink. I mean, that radiator is capable of dissipating a lot of heat.
Cool. Thanks.
So,
check out that review at pcper.com. Obviously, if you were more interested in that, I keep feeling like we need to get into doing some more water cooling stuff here, doing some more videos on teaching people that. Basically, reteaching me.
I've never done it.
Oh, one other thing I wanted to mention, too. I saw something in the chat. Sorry to cut you off on that. I just wanted to mention this before we moved on. All of the ports on the blocks and the radiator and the reservoir are all G1/4-inch threaded, okay? So you can use – you don't have to use compression fittings come with it. You can use any G1/4-inch standard threaded
barbs
fittings you want. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, so no worries there. I mean, that's pretty standard across these higher end kits. So,
all right. In a totally different area of PC building, I did a little video of a open air case from Puget Systems. Puget Systems is actually a system builder based up in the Northwest. They build pretty high end gaming machines. They build high end workstations. Mm-hmm. I think one of the systems they sent us was like a super quiet gaming machine that was pretty impressive. I got an email a couple of months ago saying, "Hey, we have this thing. Do you want to test it out and look at it?" And basically, it is an
This is a really cool thick acrylic.
It's a laser cut acrylic open air case. And he said essentially they use this for their own testing internally, and they were having them made. So why not make some more and see if they could sell them? So what you're looking at is essentially an open air case. What that means is that your motherboard, your graphics card, everything is exposed. It's fully exposed, and you don't have any. You have some retention here. Actually, it's one of the things I like about the design is you actually have. I think it's 7 or 8 expansion slot 7 brackets here, so like you can actually screw those into something, so they're actually stable in there.
Yeah,
but you can see like it's a clear acrylic. You put your power supply and your storage, whether that be SSDs or hard drives or optical drives, in the bottom. And then on top of that, you have your motherboard, video cards, whatever it is, and your
cooler. That would not look out of place at QuakeCon.
No, I think it would be pretty cool. And I think if you run LEDs on it correctly, because of the clear acrylic, if you could get the light to kind of run.
Yeah, you run the LEDs pointed at the acrylic and it
would expand spreads out, diffuse it. And I think it would look pretty cool. Yeah. One of the more interesting features I like about this particular open air case, because we've used a lot of them here because we do a lot of testing, is this space here for the 120mm mount, which is, as you can see in this screenshot, this picture rather, is that we mounted a Corsair H80i to it, right? And you can actually mount a 240mm if you want, and it will like kind of extend up over the top of it.
Yeah.
Right?
But it'll still hold it.
It's fairly thick acrylic, right? So it's pretty strong. Here's actually a better picture of that the H80.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like it's 1/4-inch.
Yeah.
Or so yep. acrylic.
Yep. Yeah. I also like, let's see if I have a picture of it. You can kind of see on the bottom shelf here, there's like this foam. It's not a sticky, like the top of it is not sticky or Velcro or anything like that, but it has a little bit of tackiness to it. So like I felt totally comfortable setting the power supply on it, setting the SSD on it, and carrying it around the office, not worrying about stuff slipping off.
It's like the back of a mouse pad.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty close estimate. It's like the back of a mouse pad. So I didn't have to like screw down any of the other stuff. It has places to screw them down if you want to. It's kind of expensive. It's $170 or so.
Yeah, but it's a lot of acrylic. That's pretty much
what
you're paying
for. It is a lot of acrylic.
Yeah.
It seems fairly high quality. It does support – it's called the Puget Systems EATX V1 Test Bench, and the EATX indicates that it supports EATX motherboards, which I would think a lot of open-air cases may not do.
That's true, but at this point, you need to.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, a lot of motherboards, if they're not actually EATX spec, are bigger than ATX. And what I thought it was cool is, like, if you don't have an EATX board, we have a shot of it straight down. You can kind of see right here. See where the power supply cables are coming in and the SATA cables coming in?
Yep.
If you have an EATX board, those would be covered up.
Yep.
But if you don't, you just have a nice, easy place to run cables and do some basic cable management. And because of its size, like, I didn't have an issue holding all these extra power supply cables underneath. Like, they weren't dangling out and causing an issue.
Now, Ryan, does it support XLATX, which is the wider as opposed to – or
longer instead of wider?
I think that's both.
No.
Well, I mean, it might if it hangs off the
– I don't – but you see how there's this arm here? See how this acrylic comes down? I don't think it will support the XL stuff because it only goes to 7 expansion slots.
Maybe if you didn't put that piece on or something.
Then you don't have a very stable thing. So I'm going to go
with –
I'm going to go with no. And the other thing I liked about it, where was the picture of that? It's got rubber feet on it that work out well. It's fairly easy to put together. It took me longer. If you watch the video, you can see some of the process. It's a lot of removing.
It takes you longer if you put it together backwards.
Yeah, if you flip one of the pieces of acrylic when you're not supposed to, and then you have to take it all apart, put it back together again, that's annoying. It's got a nice power button kind of embedded onto it, which doesn't seem like that big a deal, but it's just a nice.
It is if your motherboard doesn't have one of those.
Yeah.
On board.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a nice device. It's expensive. I know a lot of people are going to see $170 and go, I could buy
a really nice case.
ATX case for that.
That's
you definitely
true.
Can. But what's that? HSPC, is that the name of that other company we found, Ken? Something like that. High-speed PC. Yeah, that's what it was. They make a bunch of test beds like that, and they range anywhere from like $75 to $220. So it's not totally out of range. And like I said, it's a low volume thing for them. They're not trying to get rich off of this. They just thought if people want to use it,
it's definitely a nice looking open test bed.
There is another company that makes an open test bed that's acrylic similar to that called PrimaChill. They're known for fittings and they do the hard acrylic, rigid acrylic tubing as well.
Yeah.
They have a similar test bench. It's about $140, $150. The color comes with all sorts of wacky options, but it's very similar to the Puget.
Yeah, so the pricing's not out of line. So why would you want an open air case? I kind of put this in there. It's like either you're a guy that you're doing like a lot of overclocking, maybe LN2 overclocking or something extreme like that, so you need to have access to it.
Yep.
Or you swap out components all the time.
Yep.
Either you're just a frequent upgrader or you do a lot of testing like we do.
And you do not have cats?
Way to get right to my punchline there, but
that was the punchline. Sorry, I didn't read that part.
Sorry, man. Or if you just like to show off, right? Yeah. You want to make sure everybody sees your components. A window on the side of a case can only show so much.
That's true.
If you have everything out there open like this, then everybody gets to see it. But yes, if you have curious animals,
they're
cats that like to maybe stick their paws in fans.
Yeah,
I would
or lick motherboards.
Yeah, don't have. Yeah, see, that would be bad news. So if you have cats. Yeah. You know, dogs, you can keep things up on a high shelf or something. But I thought it was a pretty cool little device. I'm using it now as our CPU test bed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's...
Makes swapping the CPUs easy.
It does, yeah. Especially with that water cooler kind of mounted there. With the other systems, we always just had it kind of like hanging off over the side of the test beds.
Yep, so. One of the storage test beds right now.
And I don't have to use a motherboard box anymore.
That's true.
As well. Moving up.
Yeah.
Moving up. Speaking of moving up, is it time to upgrade our... our personal cloud devices.
So if you have not done it yet, like in other words, if you don't have one, It might be the time.
A personal cloud device being a device on your home network that is a backup device but also gives you access to files remotely.
Yes. So you could be away from home, pull up an app on some mobile device that you have, or just pull up some kind of interface on your laptop and be able to reach back to the device at your house.
Okay.
Without going through some kind of convoluted, you know, setting up port forwarding or setting up FTP servers or something like that. If you don't want to have to deal with that, right? And realize not all devices can easily just FTP in.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like iOS devices, it's not a real easy thing to pull off, right? So this way, there's just a set of apps from Western Digital in this case.
Yeah.
And they call this whole service, this whole thing is called MyCloud, right? So there's different devices that piggyback on this service. Now, there was an original MyCloud, which was just looked like a MyBook. Remember those? Looks like a little bookcase, bookshelf, external hard drive deal.
Yep.
But that only had one drive.
Right. I remember when we talked about that, and I was kind of like...
Yeah, I was like, even
if
I was...
this is your backup device, one drive is not optimal.
I wouldn't want to have a share that was a single point failure just with one drive, right? That's kind of... that's not a comfortable point for me to use such a thing. And then they kind of went to the other extreme, and they made MyCloud, like an EX4.
It was four drives.
Which was four drives, which was big overkill. And then they stepped that down, and it was still kind of an enterprise or small office kind of device, and they made an EX2, which was two-drive version, which was nice.
Yeah.
But they were kind of still missing that, you know, there's not really a consumer, a pure
consumer.
So
that's what this is. This is the MyCloud Mirror.
This is the MyCloud Mirror, which is basically a MyCloud EX2, which we reviewed several months ago. Without the enterprise-y kind of features.
Okay.
So there's no Active Directory support. There's no, like, iSCSI target support, stuff like that. There's no, like, all that kind of,
Go ahead.
Yeah. All that kind of, you know, small office, things that you would kind of really need to know your way around, like, administrative-level Windows kind of stuff to implement anyway.
Yeah.
Right? This kind of got rid of all of it, and they're just like, okay, so it's reduced feature set, but at the same time, it's, like, $20 or $30 cheaper than the equivalent MyCloud EX2, right?
Jeremy, so, I heard you were inquisitive
Well, no, but, and I wanted to say, does that mean that it's cheaper? Because otherwise that seems odd to
it
take
is.
Out.
It is. They knocked,
will you make it cheaper? Okay, fine.
Yeah, they knocked like $20 or $30 off. Yes, it's a reduced feature set. It looks like it's the same exact hardware, only in a white case.
Okay.
So it really does look like they're just, you know, they just reduced feature set, and they give you a less, fewer number of licenses to their... There's like this special software that they have that does like advanced backup across network and thing like that kind of features.
Right.
And for the EX2, they give you 10, like a 10 seat license for it. Like 10 computers can be running it and stuff. And then for this, they only give you 3 licenses.
Okay.
So it's more suited for you're just, you know, a family.
Your home.
In a house.
Right.
You're not, don't have an insane number of computers all using it.
Does it come pre-installed with hard drives? Do you install your own hard drives?
Okay. So, this even more so comes pre-installed with hard drives. The EX2 had a no-disk option.
Okay.
Right. This is, all you get is 2 gig, what is it? 2x2 gig, 2x3 gig, or 2x...
Or 2x3 terabyte and 2x4.
Yeah. 2, 3, or 4 terabytes
times
2. So
you're doing 4, 6, or 8.
Yeah. 4, 6, or 8 total capacity, but you're mirroring it.
But you're mirroring it, so okay, right.
So it's really, at the end of the day, if you're smart... And you're choosing the mirror option because you can do RAID 0 if you want, to do Deathwish RAID.
Yes, for our backup solution, we will do Deathwish RAID because that just makes sense.
But
you're not living unless you're doing it.
That's true. But I've always been impressed with kind of like how they did their software, their interface.
I was going to ask, like, is the setup easy? Like,
it is,
you hook it up to your network and plug it in, right? And you see it as a network share.
That, that's actually the most painless part of it is the... They're really good about, they just enumerate, like Windows 8 and above, it just sees it.
Right.
So, like, you know, it just shows up and you go in Windows Explorer Network and it just shows up as a network device.
Yep.
And you double click on it and it opens a browser that goes to that IP address, which gives you the front end of the thing, right?
So, the interface for it, like the setup configuration is like a web interface.
It's a web-based configuration, but you could conceivably go without ever
using
any
of
that. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it shows up as a share. It comes pre-configured with just like a public share.
Yep.
So you could just, you know, mount that, map it as a drive letter, and just start using it right off the bat, and not use, you know, if
so
you want to use.
You think the Windows based setup is good? Like you're impressed with the software and kind of how easy it is.
There's additional
to operate there?
There's software that you can install on Windows. My kind of point though is you don't have to.
Okay.
Right. There's a piece of software you can install if you're having trouble finding it on your network, and it'll automatically find it for you, and then automatically map the drives for you if you want.
Okay.
That sort of thing. There's other software they have the name escapes me right now, but there's software that you can install, Windows-based software, that will map the device as a share even when you're away from home.
So
when you're network connected, right, you can actually
it
still
looks
shows
like
up.
A local drive.
It looks like it's a mapped network drive, okay. Right? And also there's a MyCloud app for iOS and Android.
How do you, right? I mean, are those good quality apps or are they kind of like
they're very similar cheap? To the Dropbox app.
Okay.
I would put them on par. Like they can cache a certain number of gigabytes worth of data locally on the device. So in case you are not on a network and you've opened up that PDF that you opened up yesterday,
right.
It'll still be in the cache, right? Dropbox does that too.
Okay.
So it's, you know, I would say comparable feature set, except the difference is that, you know, you're not relying on some other company. This is your stuff.
Right.
Like, so if you're that kind of person that you don't want somebody else to have your files, right? Whatever those files might be, you want them to be at your house. The only thing that the MyCloud service is really doing is linking the devices together, right? It's saying, all right, how do you get to this device that's on my home network? Well, the device logs into their service, and then your mobile device logs into their service, and it basically just kind of makes the connection for
gotcha.
You, right? Which takes the headache out of, you know, configuring all that stuff yourself
yeah.
and figuring
yeah.
out how you're going to reach home when you're not at home, right?
What's performance like?
Pretty good. Writes were around 70 meg per second, and reads were over 100. Actually, closer to like 110 if you...
So that's getting up to the gigabit.
It is gigabit. Yeah, 110 is like gigabit saturated networking.
Yeah, there we go.
We hit like 108 with jumbo frames enabled. So if you have a switch or a router that enables, that can work with jumbo frames, then you'll see even higher throughputs. But we still saw over 100 even with the default frame sizes. So... even if, you know, you don't have brand new network gear or recent network gear, you're still going to see pretty good speeds.
Okay, and what about, where are they at on price? Like, you can't buy it without drive, so we're looking at $350 for 4 terabytes, $450 for 6 terabytes, $530 for 8 terabytes.
Yeah, and I mean, considering you're getting...
total drive.
You're getting a gigabit Ethernet-capable network-attached storage device
yeah.
in there with the cost of the drive.
So for $300, you have 2 terabytes of mirrored backup.
Yeah, you're buying 4 terabytes worth of storage.
Right, you're buying 2 hard drives at 2 terabytes.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the unit.
I think that's probably the part that people that don't understand backup and RAID and like...
yeah.
I bought 2 hard drives, but...
and remember...
I'm only getting access to the capacity of one.
But remember, even most importantly here, yes, this is 2 drives in one thing, but it's a mirror. In other words, it's a real-time mirror. So if you delete something...
yeah.
...off of this...
right, it's gone.
It's gone from both.
Right.
Right? So, you had 2 copies, but that only protects you from a drive failing. It doesn't protect you from anything else, basically.
Right.
Like you deleting your stuff or...
I think Western Digital has done a good job kind of expanding the consumer line of products with this stuff. I remember when they first launched the MyCloud services, we had the issues with it being a single drive and the concerns about that. But the software, yep. I was impressed with. The ease of use was always top-notch, right?
And, the software has always been pretty nice. And I think just today I saw an email that they released version 4.0 of their software, which is supposed to give kind of some more performance improvements and things like that. So we might run a couple more quick speed tests on the MyCloud and see if it made that big of an improvement. But really, there's not much more room to go on reads.
Gigabit, yeah.
So it might speed up the writes a little bit, maybe. But still, it's really good speed. If you're the kind of person that most of your devices are Wi-Fi connected at your house anyway,
yeah, it's not gonna matter.
You're not, like, this is going faster than what most people's Wi-Fi is going to do, even really good quality Wi-Fi. So, yeah.
Cool. Let's talk with Josh now because we have to. He wrote a story up on the site, fully enabling the A10 7850K while utilizing a standalone GPU, which is a complex title. We were trying to figure out today how would we title this story for it to make sense in a short sentence, and it was really hard.
Yeah.
Hard to do. Josh, explain what the target of this quick story was. Josh, I think you're muted.
You're muted.
Now you're unmuted?
No, you're muted.
Yeah, I don't understand what that control panel means.
Just whack it really hard.
Okay, fine.
Oh, there he is.
There you go.
The funny thing is, I had him muted as well.
Oh.
But I unmuted him, and then he's still,
was unmuted, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, anyway, explain what this story's goal was, target.
Well, you know, I'd always been kind of curious about APUs. What would happen if you'd run it with, like, another card, not in Crossfire, or an NVIDIA card? Would you still have the ability to address the GCN cores of that in something that you're not just running the APU yourself? I mean, we've seen lots of benchmarks of not only 3D graphics, but how it can do OpenCL type programs. And I just thought, well, what would be the point of buying this processor, getting another video card, slapping that in? And if you don't have one of the R7-250s or one of those that can actually crossfire with the APU, would you just be wasting that potential? And it seems that the answer is, as long as you keep the drivers installed for the APU and you change the primary graphics when it boots up to the PCI Express graphics slot that you've got your other card in, that primary graphics will become, the primary 3D mover. You connect the monitors to it, but you still have access to the GCN cores, and you can actually use them. So just in this very, very simple test, I took a look at Luxmark, and I was kind of curious what we'd see when we had the APU fully active with the AMD Catalyst drivers, and I've got an NVIDIA GTX 580 card with the latest NVIDIA drivers. And when you bring up Luxmark, you see that kind of setup. You have the APU, which is, the CPU, and then you've got the Spectre, which is the graphics portion of the APU, and then you've got the GTX 580. And you can choose those two things to work together. And if you look at the benchmarks, we see a nice progression of performance when using kind of everything together. The worst jump in performance is when you use the Spectre, GTX 580, and the CPU together. You get not a great jump, but if you use Spectre and the GTX 580 together, they do pretty well. And so this just kind of proves that, while this is not an HSA-enabled software product, it does allow us to take a look and see what kind of extra performance we can expect if we had an APU and a standalone graphics card, and we're using that standalone graphics card for the majority of the games that we're playing. And so it just kind of begs the question, when will we see other applications, whether it's 3D stuff, games, AI, video rendering, editing, whatever, that will actually utilize that silicon? Because otherwise, most people just buy a chip, they run it as an APU for a while, and they think, wow, graphics performance is not as good on my, 1080 screen as I'd like it to. I'm going to buy a R9 270 or an R9 280, something that's not terribly expensive. I'll put it in there, and I'll disable my onboard graphics. What exactly am I missing? Well, looking at just this simple benchmark, you're missing, quite a bit. And if we have software out there that is actually HSA-enabled that will do things like, pathing, AI, the stuff that can really utilize the highly parallel nature of the GCN architecture and offload that stuff from the regular graphics card, overall we'll have a more efficient system because more of the silicon is being used, not just the CPU, but, the GPU portion of the APU and then the full 3D card. So I thought this was a nice little experiment. It's kind of interesting to see. The drivers worked well together. The AMD and NVIDIA drivers seem to coexist pretty peacefully.
Yeah, they do that.
Haven't
pretty
had
well.
Any issues.
Yeah.
Did the sequence matter? Like, say you already had this configuration, but you just had the NVIDIA driver installed, right? Say you were just, doing the NVIDIA graphics card full time, and now you want to start using the APU stuff. Like, what would you What do you have to do? Do you have to, like...
About driver installation?
Yeah, could you just install the AMD driver?
I think you could just install it.
Yeah, you should be able to, because what most people do is they get a graphics card, they put it in, they go into the BIOS, and they say, hey, I'm going to disable the integrated graphics, and I'm going to set the PEG slot, or whatever exists in the PEG slot, as the primary graphics, and it boots back up.
Yeah.
And if you still have Catalyst driver installed, it'll say there's no device there. But yeah, if you have everything installed and then you re-enable that IGP, when Windows boots up, it'll ask for drivers.
Oh, okay.
And then you can go ahead and just install it. And because it's not Vista, which I think Vista did not allow
multiple
drivers, Windows 7 changed that, you know, went back to kind of like the Windows XP thing, which allowed multiple driver sets for graphics. So yeah, it's really easy to do. You may have a monitor that will not like being changed over in the middle of things, and you have to actually restart your machine or, you know, shut it down totally so everything can get recognized. But other than a couple of little hiccups like that, it was really easy to implement.
So it's like Lucid, but you don't need Lucid.
Exactly, and you don't have to have.
No, but
I mean,
the issue is
is Lucid still around?
Yeah, right. Lucid still. They don't really do desktop GPU stuff. Actually, got an email from them yesterday, but on the mobile space.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, they still package it with a lot of motherboards and stuff too.
Do they?
Especially the SLI and crossfire.
Well, I don't mean the full blown. I mean the Lucid, like where you could still use the Intel. Remember that?
Yeah, but they never really made that a commercial thing. Oh.
No, they showed it to us and then never released it, unfortunately, because that was kind
of
cool.
There were a lot of complications with it.
Oh.
A ton of complications. Because they were trying to do the software side.
Yeah,
trying to make it usable. Not just, like, this one application can do it because it's using OpenCL, which is, you know, very specifically agnostic to hardware, as long as it follows these specific, you know, OpenCL rules. So, it's a pretty cool thing, and it does, I think, shows what... If everybody worked together in this perfect little happy world,
you can get
what you could do with more compute resources, right? If everything worked together, but that's not what everybody wants. Not what everybody wants.
But it works.
It does
for the moment.
Let's move on to some news items. DDR3 was shown working at 2.31 gigahertz
base frequency.
Yeah, so 4.6 gigahertz total. This was a story written up by Scott on the website.
DDR3. Meaning,
Isn't
DDR3 triple the?
Yeah, that was a world record thing. I think it was a gigabyte competition, probably using LN2 or something.
Yep. So apparently a week ago, HWBot posted a video about breaking the record with a Z97X SoC LN2 motherboard, and they hit like 2.28 gigahertz. And now the first place team, which managed at 2.31 gigahertz on the same motherboard, they're using oscilloscope. Apparently recording it on video because they couldn't get a screenshot in time or something along that way. But
wow, they're looking at it with a scope.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
They're not messing around.
It's nuts.
The rise and fall is visible. And I just like DDR3 4560 because that's easy to say.
If only they just released it as a spec finally, right? I mean,
yeah.
I think we'll all be happy when the DDR4 memory comes around and we can kind of move on again. But if you're worried about, you know, your memory, so this is actually going faster. The base clock of this is faster than even than all of the like high speed memory that we have in house, right?
Yep.
At its actually double data rate, right? So what's the fastest memory we have here? Like 2400, probably. Do we have any like anything above that, Ken? Probably not. I don't know if we do, but...
100% overclock. That's nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Not really feasible, again. Useful, but interesting nonetheless. Also interesting, I don't know if we talked about this last week. I think maybe it happened right afterwards. Google announced Android Extension Pack. And I was confused about this as well, kind of what they were actually extending at all. They didn't really dive much into it. Scott wrote a news story about this. The Android Extension Pack adds tessellation, geometry shaders. I assume they mean compute shaders rather than computer shaders, as well as texture compression to OpenGL ES 3.1. And these are above and beyond, right? So as Scott posts here, it's quite interesting as it adds functionality to the API without the developer needing to target a specific GPU vendor, Intel, NVIDIA, ATI, AMD, waiting for approval from the architecture review board or using multi-vendor extensions. In other words, it sounds like developers can target Google's vendor without knowing the actual hardware. So this is like, is this like Microsoft making DirectX? And
kind of?
Yeah. In a way, because, I mean, Google is going out on their own. This isn't just a new OpenGL spec. This is something they're doing from scratch.
Right, but it's so now it's something that the SoC hardware vendors will have to support, right? Like, they'll have to make sure that their hardware...
You'd be smart to.
...stack works into these confines.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you'd be smart to, because, I mean, they're showing off the Tegra K1, and that demo video fairly impressive for a mobile device. Like, I'm sure a lot of it's pre-rendered, and there's got to be a lot of cheats going on, but at the same time, tessellation on your phone.
It's not cheats.
Okay, it's optimization.
This extension pack is set to launch with Android L, which is the upcoming release, which apparently I need to put on my Nexus 5 because of all those battery life improvements they're talking about, so hopefully we'll see that soon. Panasonic working with ARM... No, I'm sorry. Working with Intel to fabricate ARM processors, Jeremy. Was there what's interesting behind here?
Well, I mean, it was not too long ago that we were all shocked when all of a sudden Intel said, you know what, Altera, we'll start fabbing your ARM stuff for you because we got fabs sitting around. This brand new Fab 42 that we just set up, we're actually kind of mothballing because we just don't need to make that many processors right now. A mix of nothing new coming up from Intel because... Well, they don't really need to, and a general decline in PC sales, which have been, you know, having a nasty effect on the market. So if you've got a fab sitting there at low capacity, why not use it? So in this case, Intel decided, hey, ARM, we can fab ARM, and Altera was their first partner. There's a couple of other smaller ones that, like
Tabula. They were actually FPGAs. Well, yeah, a few programmable. So it wasn't, I mean, they may have had some ARM technology in there, but there was primarily.
There was a lot of FPGA.
Yeah.
But now, all of a sudden, they've got Panasonic. And Panasonic is going to want a lot of processors because you're talking set-top boxes. I mean, a little bit of mobile devices, but mostly you're sort of talking all of the Internet of Things enabled thing stuff that they're going to be selling over the upcoming years.
All that other garbage.
Yeah, TVs and receivers and DVD, Blu-ray players,
Panasonic
everything.
Still make TVs?
Panasonic they're still one of the primary panel makers.
They just announced that they're not making plasmas anymore.
Yeah, they're not making plasma. Oh, okay. They're making everything else.
Man, they were the last people making plasma.
They're going. Which I'm sure you're sad about because plasma's totally worked up there, don't they, Josh?
You know, they actually made a specific type of plasma for high altitude that does not buzz.
Yeah, well, they had to.
They had to, otherwise it buzzed.
I had no idea that was a problem.
It's a thing.
Huge problem.
Really? Huh. Yeah, up there with inflated bags of potato chips and other interesting high altitude problems.
Yeah, it's like when I fly and my water bottle compresses as I come down.
One of the friggin' neat things about this is that one of the things that Intel is letting Panasonic play with is Trigate. So there's actually going to be 14-nanometer Tri-Gate technology in some of these processors coming out. So ultra-low power, fairly good performance, and Intel will be making money even faster because Panasonic is just going to keep selling stuff.
Do you think Intel is like making these agreements and saying, as long as you don't compete in the markets we're in right now?
Pretty much, because Intel has probably never had a foothold in... Panasonic televisions or their receivers or their in-dash audio solutions.
Intel did have, they had cornered the market on Toshiba HD DVD players with Pentium.
With their Pentium 4. Oh, yeah. That was well worth their time. They figured not only can they get their workers in the fabs working, but they're addressing a market they never have. Before by proxy.
I'm fine with that. I approve.
So they're making money.
I approve. Next story, Quantum Dots on my screen. This is another thing that Jeremy posted here.
Almost sounds dirty.
quantum dots on my screen, just plastered all over it. It's pretty gross. So what's going on here with quantum dots and LCD displays?
Okay, well, quantum dots are like the next big thing in computing. This is what we're going to build qubits out of for the most part. But along the way, we discovered that they fluoresce. And they fluoresce brilliantly based on size.
That's pretty sweet.
So what you're looking at is beyond the current NTSC gamut. Not the 75% or so that you're used to seeing on your IPS now, but actually over and above. And it's all based on the size. So the larger ones fluoresce red, the smaller ones down towards blue and violet, as you can see in that picture. And those are essentially just vials full of these dots. So what they're looking at doing, and what DisplaySearch is predicting, is that in the next couple of years, you're going to start seeing these appearing in mobile devices, because they use ridiculously tiny amounts of energy. And you can all of a sudden get rid of your backlight. So you're not just have a giant white backlight trying to put through TN panel or an LCD panel. You've got a green nano dot showing with red and blue in front of it. Boom, you've got the entire gamut.
Can somebody explain to me what a quantum dot is? Is it what is it? Can I hold it? Is it a thing?
It's
these are
really
jars
tiny.
Of them.
It's a dot the size of the wavelength of the light.
It's a dot the size, but like,
yeah, it's tiny. I mean, it's probably
it has more quantum
electron
in it,
size.
It's a particle and a wave at the same time.
Yeah,
yeah,
more or less.
But no,
how
not
do
really,
you have a jar of quantum dots?
That's quantum. That's why the size of them changes the color of the light.
Okay, that part I get.
Yeah,
but what is it like? Is it
a thing that you apply energy to and it emits light?
So inside these jars, they're applying energy to it. Is that why it is illuminating?
Yes, there's a backlight on those.
I don't get inside
the
jars.
The light applies the energy. I mean, with those kind of things, you don't have to actively apply, electricity. You apply light, and light is absorbed and makes energy.
Yeah, unfortunately,
it's the other way around for what they're doing here. If they're going to
make those vials, unfortunately, it's water captured from Fukushima, and they pour in some stuff.
Hey, if you're going to get quantum dots from somewhere, why not get it from there? No, so essentially what you're looking at is a nanocrystal. It's a little tiny crystal that is a bit of a bitch to make, and one of the big problems that you're going to have with this is a lot of heavy metals are involved in it, like cadmium and that. And for the most part, you're not allowed to use heavy metals in things that people hold up to their head.
Lead free.
Yeah, well, it's lead free, all right.
So I would call them quantum.
Not help
if,
much.
If but I
so
were
you're looking
marketing.
At a little tiny crystal, about 2 to 10 nanometer diameter max. Some of them are smaller.
I would definitely go with crystal rather than dot going forward. Because
quantum dot sounds so much cooler than tiny crystal.
Well, quantum crystal sounds okay. Quantum dot made me think of like something that's not real. Like,
we secretly replaced Ryan's coffee.
Wait, wasn't quantum crystal that shitty Indiana Jones movie or something like that?
With quantum
crystal
skull.
Ah.
Let's see if he notices the difference.
Quantum of crystal skull.
Crystal dots. I was just like, or quantum dots. It's like, it's not a science. But,
more
it's,
dots.
It's a dot is not a thing. A dot is a shape. It is a point. It is a mathematical amount.
A dot.
It is.
Yes.
Anyway.
It is the antithesis of a line.
Ryan, or you'll die because of the heavy metals.
I'm fine with that. That's it. That's all we got for this week, I guess. We're going to get into our hardware software picks of the week. Let me quickly go here and see if anybody else actually put in their pick of the week. Oh, looks like we do. Have them all here. Okay, hold on just a second. Hey, Jeremy.
Pick the harmonica?
Jeremy, you can't put in 6 links.
I did not. I just wanted Ken to cue something up because
Ken doesn't do any of this.
It's Ryan.
Why?
Ryan does
it's
it.
It's been like 3
cue it for
years
10 seconds.
Since we've done this.
I just assume you don't do anything.
Ken doesn't do any of the on-screen stuff like with the anyway.
Well, Ryan's got 2 laptops in front of him.
Yeah, Ryan's double fisted in the laptops and one's bad. The battery's dying and stuff.
Yeah.
That's disgusting.
So anyway, my pick of the week is an odd branded but useful item called the Loomsing, I'm going to go with. This is a 10,000 milliamp hour harmonica style portable battery pack.
That's actually very small for.
So this is a 10,000.
It's kind of thick.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's like a harmonica, but it's got USB ports on the side. So this is a 10,400 milliamp hour harmonica style battery pack. Obviously, because of Amazon and SEO, it lists every phone ever created that it supports.
Yep.
But it's simply, it has two USB outputs on the front. One is 1 amp, one is 2.1 amp. And it's just got an interesting shape. And you've got your micro.
What does it charge at?
What do you mean?
How
quickly?
How many amps does it charge at?
Input is 1.5 amps.
That's reasonable.
Yeah. So most of these large batteries will take a long time to charge, and this is really.
I had like
no
a
Mophie
juice pack once that had like, you know,
it's got four LEDs here to tell you how much capacity is left.
The Mophie juice pack had like two or three, you know, amp hours, but it only charged at 500 milliamps. So it took like overnight just to charge.
Yeah. So we've looked at other ones that like have smart ports on them where they'll adjust dependent on how much the device is actually requesting. Yeah. And this will not do that. This is 1 amp and 2.1 amp, but it's cheap. It's $22.
Well, if you plug 1 amp into the 2.1 amp, it's only going to draw 1
right.
amp.
Right. Yeah. Right, right, right.
Yeah.
But if you have, you know, basically the 2.1 amp is for iPads and the 1 amp is for your phones.
And that's almost the battery capacity of a full iPad, I think.
10,400. I think it's pretty close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's up there. That's like probably three or four iPhones easily.
Yep. You can get it in like piano black, otherwise known as fingerprint black.
Yes.
Or it looks like they also have a white color and a, this for Ken's phone, you can get champagne gold.
Yeah.
Ooh.
They're not tailoring to iOS at all.
Yeah.
Ken's phone.
Yep.
$22 a piece, 10,400 milliamp.
$22?
$22.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't have an Apple logo on it.
Yeah, that's cheap at half the price.
I really hope that the battery is of sufficient grade, considering it's storing 10
They're so cheap, I'll just buy one.
Amp hours.
Use the charge and throw it away.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I just hope that the battery doesn't pull a typical lithium.
Catch on fire?
Ion, yeah, because that's a lot of juice to be catching on fire.
Look how fancy the box is.
It's not yeah.
Couldn't possibly. It's got a flat USB cable, too.
Did it come fully charged?
I think so.
It says it's fully charged.
Yeah. So that's my pick. There are a lot of battery packs out there, but like this is just handy. Like I'll take this to QuickCon with us.
Yeah.
Carry around for when my phone inevitably dies.
And remember, if you have one of these and you don't use it very often, store it.
Discharged?
Nope, not all the way. Not all the way discharged. Your best bet is like a quarter to a half. Charged because it will deplete slowly on its own, right? So if you don't want to, if you get it all the way dead, it might go into you're never going to charge this again mode.
Gotcha.
It's a safety, right? And in your fridge.
Well, probably not, but that's all right.
No, in your fridge. I'm like, this is not the misnomer from like Duracell batteries in your fridge and stuff like that.
No, I got you. I'm just not going to put a battery pack in my fridge. I don't think my roommates would appreciate
it. If you go months without using it, you will basically kill the... completely kill off like the fact that they degrade over time if it's in your fridge.
I thought it would cold would do the opposite.
Nope. The warmer lithium based batteries are, the faster they degrade. Doesn't matter how many times you discharge or charge them.
So just turn up the AC.
Well, yeah. And and the higher or the fuller the charge of them, the faster they degrade.
Okay.
So like the worst thing you could do, like people that have a laptop always plugged in. Always with the battery at 100% and always crunching a bunch of numbers and playing games and really hot with the battery really hot. Those are the ones that like
that's like people who plug their phone in to their car even when it's fully charged and they
just leave it.
Shouldn't a device be smart enough to not charge when the battery is full? Shouldn't it turn off the charging?
No. It'll stay full though, but the point is that if it
the battery longer, itself.
If the battery is full, it degrades faster. And if it's hot, the hotter it is, the faster
it degrades.
That's
why you've always heard you should power cycle your laptops.
I've heard literally every option with battery health.
Yeah,
so
but we said it on the show now, so it's science.
No, I mean, there's actually articles that, like, scientific articles on this.
Let's move on to Jeremy. What do you got here? Potato salad, it looks like.
Yeah, just click on that cue this for a for 10 seconds. Dear.
Wait, what?
No, skip that. But this is what's funny is that we live at a time where somebody who wants to make potato salad can make 4,300 $48,000.
I'm confused.
Wait, 43 grand. I thought it was higher than that.
I saw it at $70,000 earlier today.
Yeah, because there were a bunch of not necessarily legal donations. Like
using stolen credit cards and stuff.
I thought this was America.
Oh, really?
You're not going to play the Ross Sisters? Oh.
This is in Columbus, Ohio, so it's only 2 hours from us. We could go to the salad bar.
We could cover.
I'm going.
We could cover potato salad.
I'm going.
Yeah. It depends on what he makes. If it's mustard potato salad, like
I don't even like potato salad.
P.S. is close enough to PC that we should cover it.
Hey, Alan, we've already covered Ken with potato salad. We don't need to do that again.
We could do the P.S. Perspective podcast.
Just that day.
Just that day.
How much money we could have made.
Yeah. Dr. Evil Cat.
Mr. Shrout. I expect you to die.
All right, Jeremy, what's your actual pick here?
I'm still disappointed you wouldn't play the Ross Sisters because it's fun. Oh. Really? I'm blown away by what people have been doing with the Pentium G3258. This reminds me of the old times with like the Celeron D where you could happily double the processor speed. And in this case, I mean, it's not quite double, but 4.7 gigahertz ain't too frick, or sorry, 4.8 on air cooling ain't too bad. And it's dirt cheap. It's $60 or $70, depending on the sale that's going on. Pair that with a motherboard that Hard OCP did a review on not too long ago, the AceRock Fatality X79, which is about 120, and you've got the basis of a serious overclocking system if you're just doing pure gaming. Video editing and everything else, not so much, but if you're just looking for pure gaming, pure single-threaded performance, this thing is going to kick ass.
I have one of these. I've overclocked, haven't finished the write-up yet, and I got up to 4.6 without changing the voltage.
Yeah.
Yeah. I Tech Report screwed around with the voltage a little bit to get it up to 4.8, couldn't get it stable at 4.9, and like I say, air cooling.
4.6.
Let's deal it.
Factory voltage is awesome. Yeah.
Now, the Asus motherboard is probably doing more voltage. When you set things to auto, it will adjust voltages as it thinks to, as opposed to manual and setting it at the base voltage. But
Back in those days with that Celeron, you had to do the VDroop mod.
Yep.
Yeah, same damn thing had happened.
3.2 to 4.6 is like a 40% frequency boost.
Yeah.
Just for changing. Like I literally go into the BIOS and change one setting.
Yep.
On it. It's pretty interesting. So we'll have a little write-up on that as well.
But I'm torn because Josh just totally ruined everything by pointing out that the AMD APUs for a general-purpose machine, hell of a lot better with Spectre and a discrete GPU.
That's true.
So now I'm torn.
Yeah, but nothing uses OpenCL.
True.
Right?
Nothing uses HSA.
Nothing uses HSA.
Well, yeah. Except like what? OpenOffice?
Like I said, nothing uses HSA. Who's up next? Who is this? Josh.
Me. What did I ask again? NZXT. Oh, anyway, this looks like a neat case. It's the brand new one from NZXT. It's got like 80% more space and things for a mid-tower case. It's not terribly overexpensive. It's got nice powder coating, it looks like. It's got fans. It's got lots of areas. And it certainly looks interesting. Now, may not be for everyone. We have not yet tested this. But from what I see, I kind of like it. It's sharp looking. It's minimalist, but at the same time, it's got like
Ken would like to point out
Tron things
that
what?
We have reviewed this process. This,
we have,
this
yeah. Lee reviewed it in February.
Yes.
Damn it, Lee! He's so far ahead of the curve.
And I remember when we were talking about this on the podcast, the rest of you besides Ryan and I hated it because it doesn't have optical bays.
Here's this review right here, February 7th, Lee.
Oh.
Garbage.
Damn it, Lee Garbu.
Look at those cases. Look at those fans.
I remember those fans. I remember that case.
All you gotta do is take one of the fans out. You get Dremel, you get some acrylic, you can make a bay for it easy. Come on.
I kind of like the black.
At least think about it.
Yeah, I think I would like the black and red better, too.
I like the black and red better. It has a Space Odyssey monolithy kind of vibe to it.
Okay with the white color.
Depends if the white's going to fade or not.
Yeah, if it yellows or something. Oh, that's right. This also had the LED in the back for like your connection panels.
Ah, yes.
You could see stuff.
Huh? That's pretty nice.
I do remember
that's
that.
Pretty good.
Yeah, for only $114.
Yeah,
not too shabby.
Yeah, I agree.
Since I've gotten away from playing DVDs and Blu-rays, it's not a bad.
And you'll
deal.
Never fit a laser disc in there.
No, I won't.
Won a bet.
All right, Alan, your pick is next.
My pick is V-NAND. And the stuff that V-NAND is going to be coming in. Mainly because the latencies drop so much on writes.
So in particular, yours is the Samsung 850 Pro. The first
For the moment, it's the 850 Pro.
Okay.
Yes, that is the drive that has that. And supposedly with a to-come 850 Evo.
Okay.
Which they don't have on paper announced, but they sure were talking about it. Like, it's probably going to be a thing.
Duh.
Yeah, I mean, it's just when you're able to make dies very small like that and pack a bunch of bits onto them and do it with more endurance and more speed and less power.
Yeah, yeah.
That's like, it's like win-win-win. So, yeah.
And we just desperately want to see it in a package different than this, probably.
Well, yeah, we want to see it like something that can go faster.
We want to see it on an NVMe PCIe SSD.
Yeah, that's
right?
Probably,
because
this is the best
we've
example.
We've pegged this interface.
Yeah, that is the best example of pegging SATA 6 gigabit that we have in the office.
Yeah.
Like nothing goes.
Followed closely behind by that Corsair USB drive.
What you could do though with the less chip density or the chip density of those is you could put them, they could probably put it internally on two M.2 sticks and have it in that the 2.5 enclosure and run it on SATA Express.
Well, this is Samsung. They have the capability of making any of these things. It's just, will they sell it? Like, will they produce it and sell it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, we want them to come out with this in faster form factors because clearly...
I don't know if I'd equate V-NAND to landing on the moon like this web page.
They kind of...
I'm sure they're proud, so I'll leave it at that.
They were definitely... You should have seen the videos in...
Plus, look at that guy's tie.
In all their glory.
Hey, you know what? They did more with less than anybody else in the industry has done. I mean, think about it. This is built on a 30-nanometer process, which is so old for NAND.
It is.
Not even funny.
It is. It's like, what, almost 10 years old, right?
Sure.
Something like that. Like, 25-nanometer was in, like, 07-ish.
Look, if we're going back past 2010, I don't have any issues. I don't...
Oh, wait. No.
No, 25-nanometer was, like, 2011.
That was 11, sorry.
Yeah, but still, I mean, it's still 7 or 8 years old.
Yeah,
in terms of 30-nanometer DRAM production, and NAND. So, yeah, they reinvented the wheel. They made more with less, and it's kind of impressive because they also improved that whole write amount that they can do.
Like
what is that called?
Write endurance.
Endurance.
The endurance, and that's because there's more volume to store bits. Right, that's because of the shape of what used to be the channel. Now it's more like a cylinder-looking thing. I mean, it's actually like a container now to store electrons in, to store a charge. Right, it has a lot more volume. Right, it has arguably similar kind of surface area for electrons to leak out. Right, and it's different the way that they make the whole. It's actually called charge trap flash. It's not. It works differently. Like, it fundamentally works differently than regular 2D flash memory. Like, your typical 2D flash memory, like IMFT flash.
I'm excited. Like, these are actually... They're on pre-sale, but I don't think they're actually...
They're on pre-sale at 21st. So, 21st they come out.
Coming up soon. I asked them for some to give away at QuickCon, and they didn't.
Yeah, and I mean, you're basically... So, they're less than $1 a gig. Now, they're not like 50 cents a gig right off the bat, but this is a pro drive, not an Evo, right?
We'll get there.
And... Performance-wise, this is like one of the top performers we've ever tested on SATA. It's definitely up there.
Before we move on to Maury's pick, I will point out that several people had tweeted at me over the last week that there was a special on a PNY Optima drive. I think we looked at on like Monday.
We did.
Where you were down to like 30.8 cents per gigabyte after a rebate and some kind
cheap.
Of like purchase through this Google Master Pay thing.
And there's a bunch of controversy around that drive, which we don't have to get into it. Just realize that it most likely will have a SandForce controller in it, which might not be the controller that was in the drive when people reviewed it initially. But if you're okay with SandForce...
30.8 cents a gig. You were getting a 240-gig drive for like $74.
Yeah.
See, now, I made the request for 30, and we were almost there. And now, last week, I think I made the request for 20. 20 cents a gigabyte. Somebody make it happen. We will retweet your deal.
They need to stick
20 cents a gigabyte.
Let's get more people to 30 first.
No,
how about that?
No,
instead of
no,
just
like no, it'll all happen. Okay. Anyway, last one, Maury. What do you got for us?
All right. Well, I've been working on my QuakeCon build, and I've been having problems with my hardline acrylic stuff. Some of the fittings don't fit the tubing I have because I'm doing some custom stuff. So I was going to scrap the whole idea. But on one of the tech blogs, they talked about this stuff called Sugru, which is basically this – it's like the silly putty consistency stuff that in a 24-hour period hardens and will bond to anything, is waterproof, is not electrically conductive. It's formable into any kind of shape. You can do – I mean, they've done amazing things. It's very strong. It holds stuff up.
Is that a balloon knot?
Huh? What's
Never
the what?
Mind.
One of the things on the tech blog I saw it on, one of the things that they were promoting was they actually made a water gun using this stuff. They took all the fittings and used Sugru to bond all the stuff together in his water gun. It had motors and everything in it. It was like a machine gun water gun and you know, worked well. I mean, it's just some really cool stuff. It's expensive. I bought some at Micro Center tonight for five packets of 5 grams each. It was about $18. But for what it can do, if it actually works as advertised, it's some really cool stuff.
So does it turn into rubber or hard plastic?
It turns into some kind of hardened rubber, actually.
Okay.
I think like epoxy. But
yeah, you can see in this picture here,
bendier.
They're like showing it being like making the Lego bendy.
If Bondo was actually, as cool as Bondo thinks it is, this is what it would be.
Is it really that strong? It's only bendy when you're before it cures. Once it cures, it becomes hard. I mean, it actually becomes hard like plastic. I mean, what they call it on the thing is called self-setting rubber. Is what they call it. So I mean, the surface of it still is soft. I mean, it's soft to the touch, but it's actually hard. If it works as advertised, it's some really cool stuff. It's out of England. I think it's from a chemical company in England. It comes in these little tiny packets because once you open a packet and then the packet is exposed to air, that packet is done. You can't
Right. Can't
basically put it in a Ziploc and reuse it. But so they ship it in
Holy
little packets because
crap,
of that.
Look at the size of the gun that guy made.
Yeah, I mean that's all held together with Sugru. It's amazing.
Just Sugru.
No,
well,
it's got
some metal
parts, but I mean all the parts.
There's
are held
no
together.
Screws. There's no glue. It's just gooey fun in his face.
But and the cool hilarious. Thing is it comes in like 10 different colors, like the primary colors, and you can mix it together to get any custom color you want out of it too.
This guy's
now, the
going
liquid
right
they're
for
shooting
headshots.
Is just color. That's
Dude's
just water colored liquid. This all. But
that's pretty good.
These poor people.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's expensive, but like I could think of many things of my wife. Like, hey, look, you can make bumpers for your iPhone 5 out of it.
She needs that.
Yeah?
I mean, they show it as, you can use it for fridge repair, for cracks. I mean, I've seen it used for pipe repair. People use it for custom moldings on skis and hammers.
It instead of Bondo on cars.
So, like, how many hours does it actually take? Like, they say overnight, but like, what is it?
It's 24 hours. Is what they said, fully curing.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, it's basically it is an epoxy-like substance.
Check out this sweet like hub they made.
Yeah, you can make a hub. Yeah, people have done. People have put it on their shoe soles to repair their shoes, and it holds up. It's crazy.
So that way, you just have one thing to plug into the side of your MacBook right there.
At a time, if anything, it'll even actually
awesome.
Plug in there. Hmm.
Oh, Sugru is amazing.
Make your own dock.
And it's not new. It's been around for a while.
Huh. Oh, it's not new?
Oh, no, this is not new.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, okay. I was amazed that you didn't actually know
now
about
they're
Sugru,
marketing
because you're such a modder.
Yeah, no, I've never heard of this stuff before. I saw it on Tech Blog. It was on, Tomorrow Daily with Ashley Escada. I think the name is.
Yeah.
And the only thing even close to this is JB Weld.
Mm.
Improve a GoPro lens, yeah. Sun hood. They just molded it out.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
Oh, man.
Hey, why not?
Weird. All right, that's pretty cool stuff. That is going to be the show for us for this week. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Again, pcpro.com/live is where we record the show. You can see the schedule on any page at pcpro.com. And pcpro.com/podcast is where you can go find the RSS feeds to subscribe to, any of the back episodes, and you'll see the YouTube embeds of previous week's videos as well. If you're going to be at QuakeCon, please come join us Wednesday at 9 p.m. local time, 9 p.m. Texas time. At the Emerald Room. I'll have a post about it. We'll add that information to the workshop page, and I'll tweet about it for sure when we are there and get everything set up. And we'll do a podcast. We'll do some questions. We'll interact. We'll hang out for a little bit. And I think that should be a lot of fun. And, of course, the workshop on Saturday, we're going to have tons of prizes to give away. You want to make sure you line up early for that to get the good front row seats, because Josh's arm's really weak and he can't really throw things far.
Not far at all.
To the back, really. So, but we'll be there. It'll be fun. Looking forward to it. We'll see you guys next week. I'm Ryan Schrout.
I'm Jeremy Hellstrom.
I'm Josh Walrath.
I'm Alan Malventano.
And I'm Maury Tattleman.
Hey! Bye, everybody.
Bye.